Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, May 11th, 2025. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater, and your moderator for this morning. The share ID numbers for Friday, May 9th, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,419, that's 22,419. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,420, that's 22,420. This morning, A Vision for You presents, our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Overeaters Anonymous's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to compulsively overeat and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. The purpose of steps 1 through 9 is a personal transformation leading to a spiritual awakening. We have a transformation of thought and attitude, a change in the way we think, feel, and behave. Ideas and emotions and attitudes, which were once the guiding force of our lives, are cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions, ideas, and attitudes begin to dominate us. Step 10 captures the steps 4 through 9. It allows us to identify and have removed the spiritual sludge produced by our self-will. A life in recovery includes facing challenges and adjustments. With God's help, there are new skills and new behaviors to develop and new attitudes to practice. The Big Book stresses the importance of living by spiritual principles. The steps continue to catalyze our inner growth, our new attitudes, and our new spirit. Our way of life is the path which leads to growing in understanding and effectiveness. Joining us today to speak on this topic is Pete B., a recovered compulsive overeater from Pennsylvania. Pete is dedicated to implementing the steps in his life, which of course includes carrying the message of recovery. It's with great appreciation that I welcome Pete B. to the line this morning. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, Leah. Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Good. Good. Good morning, everybody. My name is Pete B. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm recovered today by God's grace and mercy. And, first and foremost, just to start off, happy Mother's Day to everybody. I'm really grateful to be here. I'm really grateful to be a member of Overeaters Anonymous, to be a participant in A Vision for You. And, I treasure this resource, and I treasure this meeting. And it's a big part of my recovery, and I'm really, really grateful for it, right? Leah on Friday sent me a text message, and she asked, so essentially is your presentation on step 10? And my response was, I don't know. I don't know. And so before I jump into, what I want to talk about today, growing and understanding and effectiveness from page 84 in the Big Book, I just start off quickly by telling, a little bit about me, right? I'm 59 years old. I live in Haverford, Pennsylvania. I'm originally from New York. I've been entirely abstinent and Overeaters Anonymous since May 17th of 2017. And I've become recovered from this seemingly hopeless condition since August of 2017. I found my way into OA through AA, where I've been free from alcohol since May 27th of 1997. And I've been around OA since around 2004 or 2005. I'm not exactly sure. And, you know, if you do the math on that, you know, like it literally took me every bit of 12 years to get even 1 year abstinent. You know, from my top weight to where I am today, I've lost about 86 pounds. And, you know, and since May of 2017, I've lost 65 pounds. And I enjoy a healthy, fit, an energetic experience. You know, I'm really, really like what this program says is going to happen has in fact happened to me in all areas, right? I don't track my weight, right? Because my weight is not a relevant data point to assess my wellness. I do other things and I'm not going to get into all, right? Right. And so before I jump into this thing, I'd like to say this, right? In OA's of this, invitation to you. It says that the OA recovery program is patterned after that of Alcoholics Anonymous. We use AA's 12 steps and 12 traditions, changing only the words alcohol and alcoholic to food and compulsive overeaters. Right? That's the only thing that we're changing in the literature. So if you hear me say anything that is inconsistent with what our literature says or is out of context, please feel free to bring it to my attention in the Q&A. You can call me, text me. Like I'm doing this to learn as much as I am to carry this message, right? So, you know, don't be afraid of hurting my feelings or bring it to my attention. Also, in the doctor's opinion on page XXX, it says the classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book, right? So that means, right, the categorization, right? Like there are different types, right? We're not all the same, right? Many of us were impacted differently. We come from different backgrounds. We have different drinking or eating patterns. We have experiences, you know, varying degrees of physical and mental symptoms. Some might compulsively overeat daily. Others might binge periodically. Others might appear functional for a long time before collapsing, right? So categorizing us, right, it's not easy because the condition is complex and it's individualized. And I don't know of any other recovery fellowship where this statement is more applicable, right, than it is in Overeaters Anonymous, right? Because it's so varied, right? Again, on page XXVI, it says there are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're manic depressives. To some, it presents as addiction. To others, it may not, right? We have bulimics, anorexic, overeaters, undereaters, food addicts, and I'm certain there are more, right? And I don't want to jump into claiming that I have any understanding or any kind of authority on any of the various ways that people are impacted by compulsive overeating, right? And it really doesn't matter how differently we are impacted because it's not the common problem that binds us together. It's our common solution, right? On page 17, it says, the feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we've discovered a common solution. So this is what I mean by that, right? This this is what I am. See, I suffer from, and this is what I know. I'm only authority on me. I suffer from what is known to be a twofold illness. It's both physical and mental, right? Physical in that I have an allergy of the body. When I ingest certain foods or engage in certain behaviors, I get an abnormal reaction, not an abnormal effect that triggers craving. Right, these cravings make it paramount that I ingest more food, causing my desire for more to intensify, and I never ever get satisfied. Right, the origin of this condition, where it comes from, I don't know. Right, it's phenomena. That means we know it exists, but I don't know where it came from. Right, I also know that this condition, it's progressive. It's incurable. And there's nothing human or divine in nature going to change this fact in my makeup, right? If I trigger the allergy of the body, I can't make a phone call to make it go away. I can't say a prayer and hope it's not going to happen. There's nothing that's going to stop me once that allergy is triggered. It can't be outworked. It can't be thought through. It can't even be prayed away. It's a fact of my existence, and the only way to address it is not by ingesting or not engaging in the behaviors that cause it, right? I need to be entirely absent. You know, in the big book on page XX, right, in the doctor's opinion, it says it has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Right? It says this phenomena, it doesn't say this, but I'm saying this. It actually does say this. It says this is phenomena, and it's the distinguishing characteristic of the compulsive overeater, and it's the thing that makes us a distinct entity and different from other people. That's the thing, right? That's the thing. Because, you know, so that's what I am. That is what I am before 2017 and now, right? But this is what I was prior to that, right? I was mentally ill. I was obsessed in thinking that somehow, some way, someday I was going to overcome this physical reality. Right? That's the obsession, right? On page 30, it says the idea that somehow, someday he will control and enjoy his eating is the great obsession of every abnormal eater. Right? I was obsessed with managing my outward appearance so I could prove to you and prove to myself that I was like everyone else or even better. Right? It says on page 155, it says he had, of course, the familiar alcoholic exception that few knew of his drinking. And I was convinced that if I could just resolve my perceived problems or learn to manage my emotions better or figure out the reasons for why I was being quote unquote driven to the food, that I would somehow be okay. Right? That somehow is going to reach this magical point of this thing we call food neutrality. I had illusions that I was something I never could be. Right? I had become delusional about the reality of my situation, and I became plagued, absolutely plagued with self-deceit. And I tried everything I could think of to overcome this disease. I've tried, you know, you name it. I've had bulimia, you know, you name it. I've done it, right? We all have, right? But what I never did in all of my experience in overeaters and off prior to 2017 is I never ever really got entirely abstinent and never ever got free of the substances and the behaviors that triggered the abnormal reaction. Right, I spent most of my time in Overeaters Anonymous weighing and measuring alcoholic foods, making outreach calls, doing 10 steps, going to meetings, and fighting this disease with every tooth and nail. And I never, ever could get what the program says I'm going to get from it. And now today, they say this is what I've become. I've become recovered, right? The word recover, it means I've returned to a normal state of health, mind, or strength. I've been transformed from the person that I was to the person I believe that my God would have me be. Right? I have agency today. I'm responsible and accountable for my actions and all of my decisions. I'm connected to and aligned with the power that has made this transformation possible. I have people in my life that I love, that love me and I love unconditionally. I have access to and I can utilize all of the faculties and instincts that the Creator has put inside me, right? And I seek every day to improve my conscious contact with my God and trust and rely that I'm being guided and directed, right? So I don't mean that I've become normal compared to all the people out there, right? What I mean by normal is my normal. My normal is I don't use any foods or ingredients or engage in any behaviors that trigger the abnormal reaction for me. I now have the same defense against these foods and behaviors that I have against any other threat. I make a choice every single day about what is going to go into my body because I know what is harmful or injurious for me. And I do every single thing in my power to ensure that none of these substances get in my body. And I will tell you that sanity has indeed been restored, right? I walk a free man today. So this term, right, our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Like I said, it's on page 84, right? So what is understanding and effectiveness, right? Understand means to perceive the significance, explanation, or cause of something. And effectiveness means the degree to which something is successful in producing the desired, a desired outcome. So let's talk a little bit about these two areas, right? I'll talk a little about these two areas, right? What are the resources that are relevant that could help me in understanding, right? In growing in understanding, right? And I'm going to mention these in the order of what I think, from good to better, right? That's it. Just from good to better for us, right? Well, the first resource to grow in understanding, I could rely on my experience, right? Right? Through the first 9 steps, I learned a lot about myself. Right? I learned a lot about this disease. I learned a lot about my history. I learned about the things that I did. I learned a lot about the guilt, the shame, the remorse, all the things I carried around. So that's a decent resource, right? But do I always remember exactly what happened as it really happened? Right? Am I always approaching things with an entirely fresh mind? I don't know. I don't know. I tend to remember things the way I want to remember them, not necessarily the way things really happen. Right? Another resource, right? We have sponsors, mentors, fellows, right? All those different things, right? But all those people, right? Another perspective, it's really helpful, but we have to remember these other perspectives, just like me, they're prone to bias, right? Just like I am. I'm prone to looking at things the way I want to look at things. And when I go out and look for information, I have what's called confirmation bias. Once I decide I know what something means, any kind of supporting information, I go out and find information that supports what I already think. And most people have that tendency. Right? People like me, we're subject to misinterpretation, right? Right? You know, so it's good, probably just me, but it has its flaws. Right? And then we have our literature, right? Right? We have the AA Big Book, right? The Big Book was published in 1939. And when Bill Wilson and the other members who wrote the Big Book, Bill Wilson at the time had 3.5 years sober. The other 100 early members who contributed to a certain degree to the book had anywhere from a couple of months to a couple of years sober. Right? So it's a good piece of information, right? You know, many of us rely on this. We actually look at it like, you know, it was co-authored by God, right? We have to recognize, right, the fourth edition of the Big Book, right? It's been edited. It's been proofread. It's one of the most influential and widely distributed books in the world. And most of it, about 99% of it, remains identical to what it was in 1939, right? So if that is the case, you know, every word, all of the context, all of the tense, right, all of the punctuation, right, all of it's been selected, it's been vetted. It doesn't need to be altered other than what our invitation says to try to meet the needs of compulsive overeaters so that I can understand the disease better, right? It's in a good form. It's in the form it needs to be. It doesn't need to be modified to meet our needs. I think we can all agree on that, right? But oftentimes we do. We modify it. We change it. We take things out of context, or we add punctuation that doesn't exist. We have to, you know, one of the things we have to understand is like a lot of the information is abundant in some areas, but in others, it's a little bit ambiguous or limited in others, right? Like if you think about it, right, the big book, you know, if you look at it, it has five chapters on step one. It has no pages on step two. You know, you could say maybe four chapters on step one and one on step two, right? It has 3 pages on step three, 8 pages on step four, 4 pages on step five, 1 paragraph on step six, 1 paragraph on step seven, 7 or 8 pages on steps 8 or 9, 1 paragraph on step 10, which we love to talk about in Overeaters Anonymous, 3 pages on step 11, and a whole entire chapter on one aspect or one component of step 12, right? So while it's abundant in some areas, it's limited in some others, right? So there were other resources, right? We had the AA 12 and 12. The 12 and 12 was published in 1952, right? But at that time, that was 13 years after Bill Wilson wrote the big book, right? So at this point in time, he has 18 years sober, right? It offers a deeper understanding of the steps, and it also introduces us to the tradition, right? And it offers explanations of the spiritual principles behind each step. It gives us Bill's insights about all of the steps as well as the common struggle that people face when they're working the steps, right? So doesn't it make sense that if there were critical information that we had to understand or specific details that were needed about the steps, that it would be in the 12 and 12, right? I think that makes sense. I mean, I think about my own experience, and you can think about yours, right? Think about your level of understanding that you had of this thing when you were 3 years sober versus when you were 18 years sober, right? It's different. It's different, and it evolved, right? So what I'm trying to say is that these are resources that are available to us, right? And the last one, the one that I think is probably the best means to grow an understanding, is to carry this message to somebody who hasn't heard it, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that what we were told the message was, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're telling them what we were told the message was, or that we think, or what we think it's, it means carrying what the literature actually says, right? So these are, you know, some of the things, some of the resources we could use so that we can grow in understanding and effectiveness, right? And you know, this may seem a little bit ridiculous, but what do we mean by grow? What is growth, right? Growth is like transformation, right? A thorough and dramatic change in form. We're going from what we were at one point to what we are now, or what we are going to be, right? And growth is always a process. It's never, ever an event, right? It's never an event. It's always a process. And, you know, and we have the capacity as human beings to continue to grow regardless of where we started. We grow until we die, right? And the only thing that stops us from growing, right, is not being open-minded, is closing our mind and saying, no, never, this is this and not that, right? But there are requirements to growth, right? There's things that are required to grow, right? That's like if you took a seed, right, a seed with all this potential, and you put it down on the ground and you just left it there, it needs things to grow. It needs to be nurtured. And we need to be nurtured as well, right? We need support. We need to take care of ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Like I said, we need to be open-minded, right? Because the moment we close our mind, that's when growth stops. We need to be willing and open and to learn how to and learn from the mistakes that we make, right? And we have to understand, right? Resistance, like growing needs resistance, right? Any kind of growth needs resistance. And our problems, our challenges, our disturbances, that's the resistance that brings about growth, right? So when we talk about understanding, understanding of what? What are we supposed to understand? Well, we have to understand our condition, right? We got to know what it is and what it isn't. We have to understand what we are seeking to solve for. I think we have to understand the solution. We have to understand the program of recovery. Right? We got to understand ourselves, our motives, our roles, how we relate to the world. And I think, you know, the process calls for trying to understand some type of God, a God of our own our understanding. Right? Many of us, right, we don't find our way into recovery by reading the big book and jumping into meetings. Many of us find our way into recovery by jumping into meetings, hearing what we think the big book says, and then we go and read the big book to go find information that supports what we heard or what we already know. We get exposed to what people say the literature says or some type of modified version of what it says. And when we adopt this in our mind, and we have this bias that I talked about earlier, right? But we have to grow in understanding, and that requires having an open mind. So let's talk about understanding our condition, right? Understanding what the condition is and what it isn't, right? On page XXX, it says, all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomena of craving. This phenomena, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. Excuse me. Right? On XXVI, it says, in our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out his physical factor is incomplete. On page 20, it says, now they're describing the observations that people have about alcoholics. It says, now these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. Right? On page 21, it says, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. And on page 22, it says, we are equally positive that once he takes alcohol, whatever into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. Right? So from a mental perspective, we may or may not be like other people. I don't know. I've never been another person. I've only been me. Right? I have no idea if the effect that I get from food is any different than it is for any other person, right? Like I said, because all I've ever been is me. You know, when I was first in LA, I kept on trying to find the foods that didn't cause an effect. And I get an effect from everything. I get ease and comfort, right? Because that's how I'm built. I think that's how all people are built. I have illusions, delusional thinking, self-deceit. That's not exclusive to compulsive overeaters and alcoholics, right? We have a multi-billion-dollar snack food industry, multi-billion-dollar weight loss industry. Obesity is at a record high, right? These things, this self-deceit, these mental things, not exclusive to us, not exclusive to the condition either. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, we may or may not be different than other people before we take the first bite. I don't know. I don't see where the big book says that. Right? The literature explains that we change in the bodily and mental sense after we take the first bite. Right? That's what the condition is. So we have to understand what we're seeking to solve, right? And on page 24 it says the fact on page 24, it says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, that means not discovered or known about, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent, right? That means almost, doesn't mean entirely. It says we are unable at certain times to bring into consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. On page 45, it says lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Right? So, yeah, right? On XXDI, it says, yeah, we may be maladjusted to life or in full flight from reality or outright mental defectives. Right? On page 52, yes, we could have trouble with personal relations. We couldn't control our emotional natures, right? The bedevilments. But these are human problems. That's not what we're seeking to solve. On page 58, it says there are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. You know, in the AA 12 and 12 on page 23, it actually says these distinguished men, right? These are recovered alcoholics. They're referring to recovered alcoholics. It says, these distinguished men had the nerve to say that most alcoholics under investigation are still childish, emotionally sensitive, and grandiose, right? These are all things that we have, and these are all things, but that's not what we're seeking to solve. That's not what the program of recovery is designed to solve. The program of recovery is designed to access the power that restores us to sanity, soundness of mind, body, and spirit, right? It enables us to access the power that solves the problem of compulsive overeating. And here's the added bonus. On page 42 in Fred's story, it says, quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems, right? That's a bonus. It says, I have since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful than the life I lived before. My old manner of living was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the ones I had. I would not go back even if I could. Right? Those are all nice. Those are all fine. Those are the things that could happen, but it's designed to solve the problem of not having power. And I have to understand the solution. I have to understand what the solution is, right? And the solution, I know what the solution isn't, right? The solution isn't fellowship, getting a sponsor, going to meetings, making outreach calls, claiming my seat, right? Group me, step trains. These are not the solution that the big book's talking about. Those things are human power and human aid. They're useful resources and tools that are help us to get by the day-to-day of things, right? But what page XXIX tells us, in the doctor's opinion, says unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. Because one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Once the psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. Psychic comes from the Greek word psyche. It means the soul or the mind, right? And a psychic change is a profound mental and emotional rearrangement that completely alters one's outlook, motivations, and behavior. Right? It's not talking about adopting a few new practices or working on our behaviors. Right? Page 44 and 45 says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life was sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as much as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Right? It says essential psychic change. What else? On page 13, it says, belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things, were the essential requirements. Right? Page 24, it says, when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendency, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid. On page 25, it says the central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us, which we could never do by ourselves. And I'd even challenge to say we can't do with anyone else either. Right? Psychic change, like I said, it implies a deep, holistic transformation of one's mental, emotional, and spiritual nature. And essential means it's absolutely necessary, right? So the solution is to have a spiritual experience. And that is going to require a power greater than ourselves, right? That's what the literature says the solution is. Right, and we have to grow an understanding of the program of recovery. Right, we have to understand what we're doing here today. This isn't the program of recovery. This is the fellowship. Right, this is the fellowship. Right, the plan of eating, the sponsorship, the meetings, the phone calls, the writing, the steps, the trains, the other OA tools. None of those are the program of recovery. Right. This is fellowship, and the tools are just resources that the fellowship developed for camaraderie, community, and living day by day, right? On 59, page 59, it says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. And not one of those steps mention any of the tools of recovery. Only step 5, 8, 9, 10, if we've harmed someone, and 12, even mention another person, right? That's only like 3.5% of the steps. All of the rest, they all have to do with having a spiritual experience. And we have to remember, the fellowship doesn't get real compulsive overeaters recovered because the fellowship is human power and human aid, right? On page XXIX, it says, one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. I have a bunch of other quotes in here, right? But even on page 81, I'll just forward to that one. It says that probably no human power could have relieved this thing. And like, don't get me wrong, I love OA. I consider OA my tribe. You guys are my people. I love a vision for you, right? But if we're going to give OA and a vision for you the credit for saving all these lives, who are we going to blame for the ones that don't make it, right? With or without OA, I still have this horrible condition, and I still need to be abstinent, and I still need to be, you know, I still need to be free of this merciless obsession. Right? So I have to understand what the program of recovery is. You know, and here's where I talk about step 10, right? We have to have understanding of ourselves, right? And what does step 10 say? It just says that we've continued to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I can't think of any other topic or concept that is talked about more in OA than step 10. It doesn't matter what paragraph we study or what topic it is. Most likely, we're going to hear something about this magical step 10, doing a step 10. Right? But really, if you look in the AA 12 and 12, what it tells us on page 88, that all step 10 is a continuous look at our assets and liability and a real desire to learn and grow by this means is necessary for us, right? That's what the literature says it is. We have some interesting interpretations of what the step is, right? But the 12 and 12 says what it is pretty clearly, right? What is the literature actually telling us about step 10, right? It's, well, first of all, it's telling us that it's a personal inventory. It's not another moral inventory, right? We don't do a moral inventory on every thought, emotion, or disturbance we have. We do a personal inventory. It tells us when we start to do this process, not the event, right? We start as we clean up the past, make it amends, and reconciling our severed or damaged relationships. It tells us what to watch out for, what to do when these things are encountered, the conditions that require action, and where we need to focus in order to get ourselves, in order to get out of ourselves. Right? We got to remember, on page 62, it tells us that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Right? It also says, above everything, alcoholics have to be rid of this selfishness, but we must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. On page 72, the instructions for step 5 say, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. And it's insufficient because when we do a moral inventory, we're still sick. The food may be down, but to a large degree, we're still delusional. We're still plagued with self-deceit, right? We still may not be able to distinguish the true from the false, right? But what's transpired since step 5 to now where we are in step 10? When it said on page 84, it says, for by this time, sanity will have returned. It quote, unquote, quote say, it, I'm sorry, the quote says, the problem has been. On page in the 12 and 12 on page 89, it says we never really acquired the habit of accurate self-appraisal. Once this healthy practice has become grooved, it will become so interesting and profitable that the time it takes won't be missed. Well, how are we going to develop a healthy practice of self-appraisal if we never actually self-appraise ourselves, right? If we never actually make the appraisal without the resource of another human being? On page 99 and page 100, it says, remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. Right, so the essence of this, of understanding of ourselves, of step 10, the essence of step 10 is really about self-awareness and self-examination and personal accountability. And look, obviously, you know, we can do this any way we want to do it, right? The most important thing is that we do it, right? But the literature says what it says the step is. And the literature says what the step is, what we're supposed to do. I love that term, healthy practice. Healthy practice. Do we really want to make our well-being and lives dependent upon others? Do we really want to make our well-being and our lives dependent upon the feedback that we get to somebody else? Our literature indicates otherwise, right? And the last thing we have to do is we have to have an understanding of our God, right? Prayer, meditation, counsel with others, right? This is how we improve our understanding of God. Right? Our understanding of God is a constantly evolving practice. It comes to us in countless ways, right? So these are the things that we have to grow in understanding of, right? And then we mentioned effectiveness. And just to reiterate, and I'm coming up on time, so I'm going to do the best I can to get through this as best I can, right? So effectiveness. He said effectiveness means the degree to which something is successful in producing the desired outcome, right? So I guess the desired outcome is different for everyone, right? So we all have an idea of what we want to get out of this process, right? You know, that's fine. It's all a matter of what you want, right? But the book and the 12-step recovery program, from my perspective and how I read it, it offers us an intended outcome, right? It tells us and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We will find that this has happened automatically. Right? Those are the 10-step results. That tells me, one of the things that tells me that's what the intended outcome of this process is. You know, in the foreword to the second edition, which was written in 1955, it says that of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapse. And among the remainder, those who stayed with AA showed improvement, right? That's as of 1955. What else happened after 1939 and before 1955? Well, we went to war, right? And AAs, they served in the war. And I suspect that they may have experienced some selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. I think that may have occurred, right? If somebody was shooting at me, I think I'd get fearful. I think I'd get resentful, right? I know I'd be selfish because I'd be wanting to save my ass. Do we really think that they turned around and looked around for their 10-step partner? Do we really think that we think they immediately turned to somebody and said, hey, I'm feeling uncomfortable right now? I don't think so. And look at the outcome. Look at the outcome. 50% got sober. I'm not a statistician. I'm not a social scientist. But I've observed, you know, this fellowship, and I've observed, you know, what we do here in Overeaters Anonymous, and I've sponsored the same people 15 times, right? I don't think that we're coming up on 50% success rate, right? I've heard it said in meetings that we're less than 1% success rate, right? It begs the question, like, how effective, like, we're talking about this step, we're talking about this process, like, how effective are we really being? Are we? I don't know. But I mean, we should at least think about it. Before I close, as I come up on my last minute, I'm going to go a little bit over. I just want to say one thing. I just want to say this last thing. It's a lot of things, but you know, alcoholism, it made me an embarrassment to myself. It made me an embarrassment to others. Compulsive overeating made me a disappointment to myself and a poor representation of what living a life of recovery could be. These obsessions were removed from me from the highest of powers, and I've been delivered to a state beyond my wildest dreams. I don't know where it came from, but there seems to be this narrative that we have no power, we have no ability to influence our destiny. And no say in what goes on in our minds and in our lives. Like that once we become stricken with this malady, we need to abandon our plans, our ambitions, and all our desires because we've somehow become irreversibly sick. Right? We self-deprecate ourselves and minimize our role. Right? That's not humility. Right? Humility is knowing what we are. No more and no less in striving to become everything that we can be. Right? This position that we are forever powerless is inconsistent with what our literature says and what the program offers. Any drink that I ever took or any bite I've ever taken, in the absence of the phenomenon of craving, I made a decision to take. No substance ever magically entered my body or called me and made me eat or consume it, right? I'm not a victim of my circumstances or my troubling past. Think of, this book talks about powers, right? It mentions power 77 times in the big book and 52 times in the 12-12. Every time it mentions it in past tense, except one time. And you can go find that and tell me afterwards, right? I said it earlier. I said it says on page 24, our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. It means almost. It means we still have some willpower. Page 45 says lack of power. That was our dilemma. It's not our dilemma, right? Because we found a power by which we could live, and it was a power greater than ourselves, right? We have that power. That's exactly what this book is about. It's enabled us to find a power greater than ourselves, which solved the problem. On page 53, it says it's not by chance we were given the power to reason. We have the ability to process information, to evaluate our struggles, to come up with the solution, right? Other people, yeah, great resource, great helpful. But that power, that capability exists in us. It says on page 62, he is the principal. We are his agents. An agent is a person that has been empowered by another entity to act on their behalf, right? That means that we are agents of God. We have some powers. We have the power of example. On page 69, it says, we remembered always that our sex powers were God-given, right? Maybe that one didn't need to be mentioned, right? Right? On page 85, it says, we can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. I have a will. I get to use it. I use it to align with God's will. And on page 132, it says we have recovered. We have been given the power to help others. Right. Lastly, on page 86, right, it says under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance. For after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. So this is it, and this is it for the last time for sure, right? Page 98, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. It says, burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well, regardless of anyone. The only condition that he trusts in God and clean house. 99 says, remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. Page 100 says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. And then lastly, it says, assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things that alcoholics are not supposed to do. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who can't meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. After all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles were only a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anybody or anything. We have to. And with that, I'll pass. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Pete, for your compelling and illuminating presentation this morning. Thank you very, very much. Share ID for today, 22,422. That's 22422. Pete's contact information will be given at the conclusion of the recording, so stay tuned for that. We will now transition to a question and answer segment. You can pose a question, questions only, to Pete by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Shauna H.
Tina F.
Shauna
Loretta H.
Natalie M.
Anna Yetta.
Barbara P.
Elena C.
Okay, this is who I have thus far. I've got Shauna H, I believe, Tina S, Loretta H, Natalie M, Hanayeta R, Barbara P, Elena C. Anybody else
can
want to
get
in?
Can you add Natalie S? Yeah, can you add Natalie S to that?
Yes,
two Natalies.
I believe that's the...
Yeah.
Oh, there is two Natalies. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
All right. This is a great group. Let's get started with Shanna H.
Hi, Pete. Good morning. Thank you so much. Can you tell us more about your peace that you're feeling after you have gone through everything that you described and that tremendous struggle with the intervention of sponsees and others seeking the human connection? I want to hear how you describe your inner peace.
Sure. Thanks for the question. I appreciate it. How would I describe my inner peace? Look, I have all the struggles that that we all have. I have them all. I'm crazy. I have all of the mental things that go on here. I am, right? But I do what the book tells me to do, right? When I experience selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, right? Those are emotions. I do what the book asks me to do. I ask God to remove them. And then I go about my day because they don't get outworked. They don't get outthought. They get removed. Just like the merciless obsession to compulsively hurt myself with food was removed. It wasn't removed because of, you know, because I was a good guy, all right, or because I talked to the right people. It was removed because God removed the obsession. Right? So when I'm not peaceful or when I encounter these disturbances, I do what the book says. Now, if as a result of those emotions, I take some kind of action, and in those actions, I harm someone, right? That's a specific word, harm someone. When I discuss it with somebody and I figure out how to fix it, make amends, repair it. But if I just have those emotions, I ask them to be removed. That's what happens. They get removed. And I go on about my day like they're not there. I focus my attention on how I could be helpful and useful to those about me. Right? And that's where I get peace. Right, just because I'm making these statements or have these understandings or anything, I'm affected by it all. I'm in the process of of tremendous personal and household upheaval and disruption. Tremendous pain, tremendous destruction, all different kinds of things as a result of lots of things. I know that none of that stuff is going to be reason enough to eat. I know that none of that stuff is going to be reasonable enough to lash out. If I do, I have recourse for what to do about it, right? While all these things, all these disturbances have happened, I have trust and reliance that I'm being guided and directed. I'm making decisions based upon the intuition that I've developed, and I trust and rely in God that He's putting me in the place that He wants me to be. I trust and rely that God is putting the people and the resources in my life that I need to benefit me. I trust and rely that God is removing the people and the resources in my life that are no longer serving me. And I carry on the way that I think the book tells me to carry on. So I hope that answers your question. And I thank you for asking it.
Thank you, Shanna H. Tina, it's your turn.
Thanks for service, Leah. Thanks so much, Pete. What a great message. My question, well, first of all, I just wanted to state that, you know, somewhere along the line, you had talked about the doctor's opinion and how we're bodily and mentally different. And I think in the book, it does say that we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. I'm not sure what page I'm out walking, but I'll find that. But my question is, you know, when you're taking somebody through the steps, you know, because this is my dilemma today, and, you know, we're getting through the steps, we're on step four, we're all good to go and abstinent through the whole thing, and then they eat on step four, okay? And this is, you know, and I take them through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We do column by column. And first column they do and they're fine. Second column they eat, you know, and then we wait a few days till they get abstinent again. And then third column they're, you know, they're great. Fourth column they eat. What's your, how do you, what do you do with sponsees in that specific instance? That's my question.
Thanks, Tina. It's good to hear you. So first of all, I just want to clarify, right? I want to address the first part, and then I want to come back to the second part. The doctor's opinion says that there's one thing that this thing resists from other people and makes it a distinct entity, and that's the abnormal reaction that we get to the substances. We may be mentally different from other people before we eat. We may have different psychosis or different sensitivities or different things. We may be, I don't know. I've never been another person. But what I do know for sure is when I become bodily and mentally different, absolutely sure, is when I take the bite. When I take the bite, that's when I get the abnormal reaction. That's what it tells me in there is a solution, right? I mentioned snack food industry, the weight loss industry, all those things. There's shit going on out there. You know what I mean? I don't know if my mental thoughts, you know, before I eat are any different than anyone else's. But what I do know for sure, and what the literature tells me, is that I'm bodily and mentally different because of the reaction that I get to these substances. Okay, so what do? Somebody gets to step four. They're chugging along. They're having, you know, and then they go eat. Well, recommend that they go back, you know, start thinking about what the first step in recovery is, right? Not step one, not this admission, I'm powerless over food and my life is unmanageable, right? Or we were powerless over food and our life had become unmanageable, right? That's step one. The first step in recovery. Have you really conceded to your innermost self, right? Conceded, meaning you bought this thing down to a cellular level, like you know for sure that you have this thing. You know for sure that you're not like other people. You're never going to be like other people. You never were like other people, right? Has that delusion been smashed? So I review that information, right? I ask, what's your definition of sanity? What are you expecting to come out of this thing, right? Do you know what the book is talking about? Because the sanity isn't talking about being able to balance my checkbook better. Or do the things I'm supposed to do when I'm at work. All sanity that they're referring to is the big book is that I'm able to bring into conscious force with sufficient, I'm sorry, I'm able to bring into consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the pain and suffering caused by food, and I'm going to make the decision not to put it in my body. Right? I review the proposals. I ask, did you really make a decision, right? Decision. The root of the word decision is scission, means I cut off. Have you really decided that your life and will is God's, right? Or did you take that back? Are you giving it a portion of it, right? Because I don't think it's possible to do an effective four-step to really, really dig into your resentments, which are, whatever, but your fears. Right? Why am I afraid? Right? And look at our conduct with other people and how we lived inconsistent with our inherent ideals without really making that decision that no matter what happens, my life is in God's hands. Right? I just have to review those proposals and then get right back up to doing the inventory. Did you miss something? Right? We're not gamifying the condition, right? We're having a spiritual experience. We're trying to have a spiritual experience. So unless the foundation is put in place with those first three steps, remember I said, you know, we got Bill's story, the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, more about alcoholism, we agnostics, all of that information is all driving home the hopeless nature of this condition. If somebody went out and chose to eat again, right, they either triggered the phenomena of craving or craving still exists because the stuff that we consume doesn't go away like alcohol goes away, and they can't resist the temptation, and they make the decision, or they react, or they respond to the phenomenon of craving, and they eat. The only thing to do is to just make sure the foundation is, in my opinion, is to make sure that the foundation is properly in place by reviewing that information and then moving on. That's what I do. Moving on with them. So I hope that's clear.
Thank you, Tina, for the question. Loretta H., you're up.
Good morning, Leah. Good morning, Pete. Thank you for digesting, understanding, and effectiveness with the big book. And happy Mother's Day to everybody. My question is, and I may have heard this very incorrectly, so correct me, please. But you said that came to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore us as humanity really wasn't positioned in any of the chapters, but yet you read chapter 4 and the spiritual experience in your, you don't, and maybe I did not hear you correctly, these aren't important for me as a compulsive overeater or how I came to believe. And maybe I heard it wrong, so please share with me on my incorrectness or my correctness. Thank you.
Thanks, Loretta. I have no idea what you're talking about. Did I say that? Maybe somebody can come off mute and tell me what I said, because I don't remember saying that.
Okay. I thought I heard that, and maybe I'll have to reread it, and then we'll speak later, or replay it,
sure.
And then we'll speak
later.
Yeah,
if anybody's out there heard me say that, if they could tell me, you know, feel free to let me know.
Okay. Because you did reference it. Thank you. You did reference the two things which helped me. But you said that, you know, that first 59 or 58 pages were devoted basically to step one, and then we get into 3. And maybe I misheard you, so please, I amend
what
it
I,
if I
what,
did.
What I said, what I was referring to is that the information in the big book that we essentially have 5 chapters related to step one. I don't think we have a chapter dedicated specifically to what step two says, which is came to believe that a power greater than ourself could restore us to sanity. I'll say, okay, maybe we agnostics does, right? So we have 4 chapters on step one and 1 chapter on step two. That's what I said.
Okay. I didn't hear it that way. And so that's what I was curious as to what you meant. So thank you. Okay. Thank you, Pete. Have a beautiful day and God bless.
You too. Thank you.
Thanks, Loretta. Mm-hmm. Moving on now, Natalie M., your turn.
Good morning, Pete. Thank you so much for your share. I found it very empowering. My question is, how do you evaluate your level of recovery? You've made it clear that, I mean, if we're going to do a dipstick every now and then and see where we're at, you've made it clear that, you know, you're meeting your target weight is not your measure of recovery. How long you've been abstinent, that's not your measure of recovery. And you alluded to maybe it's being truly who God created me to be, using all my talents, or maybe the depth of my relationship with God. Could you clarify that for me? How do you evaluate where you're at in your recovery? Thank you.
Well, yeah, so thanks for the question. I appreciate that. I'm going to put my timer on when I answer this because I'm long-winded. And look, right? What does the book say about, which is Fred or Jim, right? He drank because he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. You know, there's no metric on spiritual life. There's no metric on spiritual progress, right? You can measure lots of things. You can check your bank account, your 401k. You can weigh and measure your food. You can, you know, there's lots of stuff you can measure, but you can't measure spiritual progress, right? We're people, like it tells us, right? We can't distinguish the true from the false. We have, you know, our head lies to us at times, right? So How do you measure your spiritual progress? I don't think you do. I don't think you do. I base how I'm doing on the actions that I'm taking. Right? That's I don't base how I'm doing on the feelings that I'm having. Right? Did I get up this morning and upon awakening get quiet and seek guidance and understanding from the God of my understanding? Did I petition my God for what I need, the power, the strength, the courage, and conviction to get through this day without seeking a drink or a drug or any of the substances that trigger the phenomenon of craving?
Mm-hmm.
Have I made a plan for the day, right? Have I planned out what I'm going to eat, how much I'm going to eat, when I'm going to eat it, where I'm going to get it from, who I'm going to eat it with, right? Am I executing according to that plan, right? At the end of the day, did I take a look at how I interacted during the day and, you know, just and figure out if I was behaving in a manner that's consistent with the way I think my God would have me behave? Am I behaving consistent with my ideals, right? Am I putting my head down on the pillow and got through all those things? Then I'm doing fine, right? I base it on the facts, and those are the facts. See, my feelings, what are the emotions I'm having? They're not facts. Those things that happen to me, any emotions that I experience, they're just like any other thought I get, like when I'm in meditation, right? What does meditation teach us? We don't change our thoughts. We don't chase them out of our head. When they come in, we observe them. And when I observe them, they come and they go, just like any other thought that happens. Right. So I observe it. I don't attach to it and I let them go. And that's what happens. Right. So there's no way. It's not in the quantity of people I sponsor or the how many times a week I share on a vision for you. It's none of those things are a measure of spiritual progress. But the only way to make sure that I'm making it is to make sure that I'm doing the things that this process calls for to do. And then I get through the day and, you know, every once in a while, I get to look back and be like, "Halt him." You know, look at what has transpired. Look at what I've encountered and overcome. Like, look at what my God has made it possible for me to do. And I get moments of extreme joy and gratitude. You know, so that's how I do it. That's how I do it.
Thank you, Natalie M., for your question. Next question comes from Hanayeta R.
Hi, this is Hanayeta R. from Texas. Thank you, Leia, so much. I really appreciate you so much. And wow. Pete, I love listening to you. You always speak with such passion, even in your three-minute shares on the vision meetings. You're just always so passionate, and I love it. My question, well, I just need to preface it with the fact that step 10 says we continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. And so when I'm wrong, and I do somebody wrong, or I hurt somebody's feelings, or whatever, even if I don't think I'm doing it, I make amends to them. But sometimes I feel like I fall really short because there are people, lots of people, who say you should be taking 10 steps all day long. Well, even at the end of the day sometimes, I don't, when it says am I resentful, I go, no, I have not been resentful. How do you feel about having to do 10 steps all day long? Or do you feel like you should always find something that you were resentful about at the end of the day? I don't know. Sometimes I feel like maybe I'm doing it wrong, but it's just what happens with me. I was wondering what happens with you.
Thanks, Hanayeta. So this idea that I have to do 10 steps all day long is self-centered and self-seeking. That's what it is. It's self-centeredness. That's it. Period. Dot the end. It tells us when we do a 10 step. It doesn't tell us when we do a 10-step. It tells us when we use this process. It says when these crop up. So we do the process when selfishness, dishonesty, and resentment and fear crop up. That's when we do them. If they don't crop up, we don't do it. We don't get anything from half measures, and we definitely don't get anything from extra measures, right? And, you know, this idea that this is something that, you know, if I don't sit down, like I looked in the 10 step, I looked in step 10 and the 12 and 12. I looked in step 10. I read everything that the whole paragraph on what it says in the big book on step 10. I don't see where it indicates there's columns. I don't see where it indicates that I'm doing a moral inventory on every single emotion that I have. I don't see that it says that. I definitely have never uncovered anywhere where there's some kind of form I need to follow when I'm taking it, somebody's step. I don't see any of that anywhere. Right? To me, that just is an indication of our selfishness, our self-centeredness, right? Because if we're focusing on what's going on with us, we're only focused on ourselves. And we don't outwork that. We don't outthink that. These things don't get resolved. These things get removed. And the more time I spend focusing on them, the bigger they become. The less time I spend focusing on them and watching them pass like they pass, the less impact they have on my life. There's nowhere anywhere in the AA literature that I could find that says anything about buildup of human emotions. It doesn't say that. Can't find it anywhere. Now, we may interpret that it says that, but it doesn't. Right? So we have this literature. We don't have to change or alter the literature and modify it so it addresses to our kind of unique personalities. Right? What they used to say when I first came around, they said, the difference between alcoholics and compulsive overeaters is alcoholics take the disease serious and overeaters take themselves serious. I am the root of my problems. I need to spend as much time out of me as I possibly can. And the way I do that is focusing on somebody else. So I hope that that's helpful.
Thank you so much. That really is helpful. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Hanayeta R. Barbara P., your turn.
Hey, Pete, Barbara P., thanks so much for all your love and service. Appreciate all you do. Question, it keeps coming up lately, this sort of the difference between 10 and 11, another step 10 question. I feel like I know it, but I don't know. There just seems to be, even in the literature, a little bit of overlap. Could you kind of give us, I don't know, what you've seen as you've studied the literature and your interpretation?
Sure, Barbara, thank you. It's good to hear your voice. So, look, like again, what does step 10 say? It says that we continue to take personal inventory. Not continue to take moral inventory, right? We're continuing. In the 12 and 12, it even talks about it. It says we do a spot check inventory. That's what we're considering step 10 to be, right? When these crop up, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, we ask God to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends if we have not hurt someone, harm someone. That's what that says. So that's a spot check. When something crops up, when something happens, that's what we do. Again, in the 12 and 12, it talks about spot check inventory. It talks about evening inventory. It talks about periodic inventory. It even, I think it references, I'm pretty sure it's referencing this, is sometimes we go back and we do a cold fourth step all over again. We do a whole moral inventory again, right? So in essence, like I said, the 10th step, all it is it's about self-awareness. It's about just being mindful of our thoughts and our behaviors and our mental state and spiritual state And then doing something when it crops up, right? It's a spot check. And then obviously we have the other things, right? But all that it says is just we continue to take personal inventory. So we're continuing to look at ourselves, not put the blame and the cause on other people, right? And recognizing what the problem is, and most importantly, going to the source that's going to remove it, right? Because it says that we can't get rid of self without the help of God. And God's not my 10-step partner. God's not on the 10-step train. I don't even know what that is. I don't even know what it is, but I was on a meeting yesterday that we, like that's all it was. It was like a 10-step train meeting. But I'm sorry, I regress. But anyway, that's my understanding. 10-step is a spot check, but it's really talking about continuing to take personal inventory. 11-step, right, is something that we do. Our 11-step inventory, right, is at the end of the day, throughout the day, right, where there, you know, that's what I'm getting from it.
Thank you, Barbara P., for your question. Next up, Elena C.
Good morning. Thank you, Leah. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. And Pete, I love you, brother, in recovery. So I love your passion and your outstanding job. I have a question somebody asked. I mean, in my overlap, would want a question like, how do you work with a chronically relapser? I think you heard, you answered something about that. But also, how do you let go of people who can't stay in abstinent and without being harsh and still kind of, from a conscious context standpoint, how do you let them go? Thank you.
Thanks, Elena. Appreciate it. Okay. How do I let them go? You know, I tell you what, man, the first person, when I got recovered in 2017, I sponsored a person. When I was told me, and this was helpful to me. She told me she doesn't sponsor relapsers. So she'll work with me, but if I relapse, she's no longer my sponsor. And I don't know why, but I wanted her to sponsor me. I really don't know why. She's nothing. We're completely different people. But I just wanted her to sponsor me. So I took it serious. Like, you know, if I relapse, I can't work with her. Then I'm going to have to ask one of these other people who get on my nerves. I'm going to have to ask one of them to do it for me, right? So I took that same, the same, you know, what do we call them? Our non-negotiables, right? These things like we had, these rules we have, right? And I took it. And then I worked with this woman and she worked really, really hard. She worked really, really hard. And this disease is, you know, we all know it. We're all chronic relapsers, man. I don't know if I've ever met anybody who came in here, you know, put down the food 100% on day one and you know, had a spiritual experience and walking hand in hand with God. And I'm sure they're out there, but I don't know it. And you know, she picked up and I told her I had to go. And it plagued me even to today. Because I don't think that anybody has to be that rigid, right? Like our rules, our non-negotiables, our thing, they're not getting anybody recovered. We're not talking anybody into doing this thing, right? The food is carrying the message. The food is the one that's going to dictate what we're going to do and when we're going to do it. Bill Wilson didn't leave the Mayflower Hotel to go find Dr. Bob because he was trying to help Dr. Bob. He left the Mayflower Hotel because he was trying to save his life. So I'm not real eager to get rid of anybody. I'm not. I don't think I'm causing anybody damage because I'm not causing them to get recovered. I hold on to them because they're valuable. You know, I love getting calls from my sponsees. I love getting calls from people I work with. I love having the opportunity to engage them. And I love hearing from them. And guess what? When shit's going bad for me, they're going to hear from me. right? Not to talk about me, but to talk about them, because I got to get out of myself, right? So, but in the event, like the only thing that causes me to not work with somebody is if I say, okay, right, this is the step we're on. Do the step, right? Have you done the step? Yes. No, I haven't done it. Okay, don't call me again until the step's done. And then I don't hear from them. That's really like the only time I, you know, that I let them go. And like I said, more because I don't believe that I've gotten, you know, we have the power to help others. We help them with our example, right? I don't believe I have the power to get anybody drunk or make anybody eat. And I hold on to people as a valuable resource. Maybe it's, I don't know if it's to their detriment or not, but usually when there's other plans, those other plans materialize and those people, you know, are no longer around. And I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to engage with them. And I wish them the best and hope that their journey finds, you know, lands somewhere else. And when they come back, I nearly always take them back. You know, it's just because, like I said, we are not the source of recovery. Right. They are. We work with others to help us. We don't work with others to get them recovered. So that's all I got on that one.
Thank you, Elena C. Okay, let's see if we can squeeze in this last question from Natalie S. We have a couple moments here. Natalie, your question, please.
Thank you. This is Natalie S. in Indiana. And my question, Pete, is around this saying that I've heard. I've been here just a few, you know, 2 or 3 years, but it's that the disease is progressive, and there's another word there I can't think about, but progressive something and fatal. And to me, that puts a lot of fear about what's to come and that I have to work harder, that it's more about me. And I just like your experience with a progression, or if the big book speaks about a progression of the disease, and your thoughts on that matter. Thank you.
Yeah, sure, Natalie. So yeah, it's a progressive illness. It only gets worse. It never gets better. That's what progression means, right? It never gets any better. Yet you hear many of us, myself included, announce myself as recovered. Right? The sensitivity, the abnormal reaction that I get to food, that I have to food, that is only getting worse. Only getting worse. I am getting, as I age, I am getting more sensitive to the substances, and most likely I'm going to have to eliminate more things than I am going to be adding things to my food, to the foods that I eat. That's just the reality of the situation. Right? But recovered, right? Recovered means that I've returned to the normal state of mind, right? I'm back to a normal state of mind. I am rigorously honest with myself about the reaction that I get to these substances, and I make a decision not to ingest them under any and all conditions. Under any and all conditions. Right? And what the big book tells me is that abnormal reaction I get from the substance, I can't get it from something else. The only thing that can trigger that phenomenon of craving is ingesting the substance or engaging in the behavior that causes it. For me, right? I explained what I am, right? And like I said, that part's only getting better. But the mental part of this disease, right? The mental obsession. Well, it says recovered, right? I've been restored to sanity. I make the appropriate decisions about what goes in my body. I don't read that it tells me I'm going to continue to get mentally ill. I don't read that I'm going to deteriorate mentally and then not be able to, you know, with God's grace and mercy, make a decision not to pick up the foods. I mean, to pick up the foods that cause the phenomenon of craving. I don't read that it says that anywhere, right? So left untreated, the disease only gets worse, never better. The treatment, is entire abstinence and pursuing a spiritual life, right? Having is pursuing an entire psychic change. The 12-step recovery program, if implemented, is outlined in the book, will cause me to not have to, you know, to like that's the treatment. Now I'm getting lost. So because we're at the end of time, I'm gonna shut it off there. I'll think more about the question, but hopefully that was helpful. And you know, feel free to reach out and call me anytime.
Thank you, Natalie S., for the question. Thanks to all who posed questions this morning. And of course, thank you, Pete, for your informative and profound presentation this morning. Another gem for the archives, indeed. Share ID 22422. That's 22422 for Pete's presentation this morning. And we're going to close now from page 164. It's found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.